So good morning, good afternoon, good evening to all of you. Naturally, we have to include all of the time zones because we have people who attend this broadcast in almost all the time zones. I just feel badly for the people who are over in the easternmost parts of Russia listening, because they get very sleepy because it practically becomes early morning. Late night, early morning for them when this broadcast is on. And for us here, we are just trying to wipe the sleep out of our eyes and become aware enough that we could speak properly today. I've had a very interesting set of experiences in the last weeks, where I have been having to deal with dealing with definitions. And part of these definitions deal with the fundamental way in which I relate with others and others relate with me. And I think that this is an important experience to share, not because of a need to be egocentric, but because I think it is something that we all share in our lives. If you see the lecture title today, is Foundations. And that, of course, is a very wide term, a very broad term, as it should be. Because a foundation is that upon which everything in our lives rests. And it holds us, it supports us, it gives us the capacity to build upon this foundation and grow and evolve upwards and outwards. Now, legally, in the legal sense, in the sense of what would be in court, one of the most important aspects of a organization, and I'm going to compare us as beings to an organization, are to have a very clear definition of what you are. Because if you do not define what you are, others will define what you are, and when others define what you are, it may not be what you wish it to be. And unfortunately, when others define us, they do it in a totally different way than we could even imagine. Now, we assume that the definition of what we are is a given. It is a given. It is what we are. It is natural. It is obvious. It is self-effulgent. It is self-explanatory. Yet, when other people see us or deal with us or experience with us, they think or they understand us in a way which shocks us sometimes. We say, what? How could you think like that? How could you even consider like that? We become surprised. We become bewildered. We don't understand how this response to us has occurred. Now, in the organizational sense, lawyers always tell their clients who are companies, you must have, but not only companies, but organizations of any kind, even religious organizations, you must have a very clear definition of what you are, because if you don't, the court will define you. And they may do it in ways which you disagree with. And you may be surprised how many organizations, how many people run into this very same problem. They assume that their definition is obvious, and when it is tested, they see it is not at all obvious. We make assumptions all the time. We make assumptions about other people. We make assumptions about life. We make assumptions about our economic situation or our social situations. We just assume things like it'll be okay, or this is fine, or that's great, or everything is whatever. So these definitions that we make, these definitions which we assume within ourselves, can often be nothing but a belief. How many times have you been in a relationship, sometimes intimate relationships, sometimes not so intimate relationships, where you just assumed the nature of the relationship only to find out, or even assumed in a way where you became complacent only to find out later on that was a huge mistake? People thought that you were being very lazy and inconsiderate to just assume that everything was all right without investing further in the relationship. Now, why is this so? I would like to assume. I think it is so because we are afraid to see what the truth is. We are afraid to be clear. We take shelter in vagueness, because in vagueness there is comfort, because you can defend yourself later on against attacks when the definition is vague by then redefining yourself in a very good way to defend yourself. Now, people do this all the time. For example, when they're starting a relationship up and they have some reason to make a connection with another, maybe an economic reason or a romantic reason or whatever. So they adjust what they like or dislike to the likes and dislikes of the other person in order to make the relationship be easier, make the relationship flow better. Sometimes we have this insane situation where one person pretends to like something because the other person pretended to like it, thinking that's what the other person wanted. And they end up doing something neither of them like because each one thinks it's what the other likes. How many relationships are born out of desperation where a person thinks, I don't care what I have to do to adjust in my life. I really need this relationship. Therefore, I'll just be anything required. Now, life is complex. There's no easy answer to this. There's no way. I'm not going to give you a formula and say it's like this. It might just be right now for you most important to have relationship, and therefore the sacrifice of the clarity of your own definition is not a significant factor. But at one point, it becomes a significant factor. And at that point, one laments about the choices and decisions one made that brought one to this point. We can call it a moment of reckoning, where you have to face your choices, the consequences of your choices. And this moment of reckoning, as we might call it in English, it's a kind of, I guess, this time of reckoning, it's a kind of a Christian term, I suppose, but it works very well. It's in many, many religions, that time when you die, you go before some judge, you go before somebody who kept record of what you were, and then you are given a judgment, a sentence, either in some to go down or to go up or to burn or to be happy or to whatever. So this idea of moment of reckoning, it's a very interesting idea. It's an idea where we have in our minds that we're going to have to pay for what we have chosen to do. Because we know we're not doing it right, we're going to have to pay. So this moment of reckoning is something that everybody believes deep down they're going to have to meet. Now, this relates to the concept of foundations very directly. Because if you were to define what is a foundation, you would understand it better. The foundation means that which everything rests upon. That is the ultimate definition of this word. Now, is there an absolute understanding of what everything rests upon? Is it really an absolute thing? Or is it perhaps a relative thing? Or is it perhaps a mixture of some sort of reality and what we make of it? Now, I can't answer that clearly. I mean, clearly, of course, but I can't answer that definitively. I cannot give you a definitive answer. It is this percent this percent that. Because for each of us, it is completely different according to the way we have defined ourselves. Now, I feel, and I think most of us who are listening to this broadcast would agree, the definition of our foundation, which comes closest to the absolute that everybody would like to have, is our spiritual essence as being that upon which everything expands, everything grows, everything rests, everything is given energy by. This is a foundation you can depend upon. This is a foundation that is out of your control to alter. I've seen this in my own life, and after all, we started off this lecture speaking about how this is an expression of my personal understanding over the previous time, this previous time period. I've seen it in my own life, how what I am is unalterable. My nature, my essence, my very fundamental being is unalterable. It is a given. It is. Now, this given, when I use the word given, I don't mean somebody gave it to me. I mean that it is to be accepted as the basis. It is to be accepted as something which is primordial. It is not open to question. It is axiomatic. And yet, if you think about it, because of the nature of that essence, how I manifest the structure upon that foundation is very much dependent on the foundation itself. We're all different people. We all have different unique foundations, but we are all very similar in the fact that we have foundations upon which we grow. Considering this, why do I feel afraid that somebody will be able to perceive directly my foundation of existence? Why? Why do we have to create illusions about what we are to facilitate relationships? Why do we have this fear that what we are is worse than what we pretend to be? Now, I know this is just like one sentence I've thrown out amongst many sentences, but I'd like to repeat it because it is so fantastically significant. Why is it that we feel that what we pretend to be when we present ourselves to the world around us is superior than what we actually are? Why is this so? Now, if that fear is based on a lack of confidence or based on a lack of love for the self, do you really think that your artistic acting creation, the creation you are making of yourself, which is an act, would be good? If you lack confidence, why don't you lack confidence that the act or presentation you make is also not very good? Now, let's take, for example, actors. I know it's a little bit of a diversion, but it's a very interesting subject to discuss about actors, professional, highly qualified actors. An actor, a really good actor, is a very deep, perceptive, aware, and sensitive person. Because they can get into the mind, they can get into the emotion of, they can accept the psyche of a character who's completely foreign to them. Now, how can they do that? I mean, after all, if you think about it, how can you convincingly portray someone who's completely opposite to what you are in your essence or reality if you don't have that intense sensitivity to enter into the psyche of that personality you're playing and become that person? Now, because actors have a very great confidence in their capacities like that. They have a great confidence in their abilities like that. That doesn't mean they don't get nervous when they go on stage, but they have this confidence in their ability to become somebody. They let themselves go. They're not afraid to let themselves go into a character. This proves that they have an extraordinary intelligence and capacity and sensitivity, which is quite a gift. Yet many of these actors have very troubled relationships, have a very difficult time connecting with others for long term. Why? I can't give you a complete answer, but I could suggest maybe it is due to their finding it difficult to set aside what they can portray as compared to what they really are when they are that sensitive and very deep individual. And I'll give you an example. There's a very, very deep line I saw in a movie. Just one line, but it was so deep. It so affected me in my consciousness. It was a movie that had Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant in it. Hugh Grant was playing an ordinary man, and Julia Roberts was playing one of the most famous movie stars in the world. And somehow or another, she became attracted to him and was staying with him one day. And naturally, one thing led to another, and they ended up in the bed. And in the morning, when she woke up, she said something very significant. And she asked him, "Do you still like me?" Because she said that most people in the evening go to bed with the big movie star and wake up in the morning with the real person. And it unnerves them. Think about these movie stars. Think about these famous people who are musicians. Think about rich people. Think about politicians, anybody with something special in this world. There's a mystique about them, a mystique, a kind of an impression that everybody has, that is a charade that is being disseminated as part of their role within society, which makes them that special person they are. And when people relate with them, who have that mystique, their whole perception of them is colored by these external things. Their musical capacity, their acting capacity, their political capacity, their wealth, or whatever. Sports, strength. Now, we tend to idealize others. We tend to place others in this ideal condition and not see them as people. Not see them as people who are also a spiritual fundamental essence. And we tend to push them in the situation where they feel that maintaining relationship with us means to maintain this ideal which we idealize, not necessarily that they idealize. Sometimes we become prisoners of other people's conceptions. Prisoners. We are chained by other people's conceptions of us. And why is this so? Why have we allowed this to happen? Well, I would think it's because, actually, to a large extent, it is out of our control. How many of us when we were children, all of us when we were children were defined by our parents' expectations, we were defined by the teacher's expectations, we were defined by the social group or friendship we were in. From the very beginning of our life, we were behaviorally modified from birth to accept these definitions which people have placed upon us because we really had no choice. Now, of course, I know some of us are thinking, well, not me. When I was a teenager, when I had the capacity to be free, I defined myself by rebelling against all of that. I stood up for myself. I rebelled. I rebelled in all kinds of ways. Some of them subtle, some of them gross, some of them overt, some of them covert, some of them internal only, sometimes in the external. I was defining myself in this rebellion. But think about that. Think about what it means to define yourself as a rebel against something else. That means you are chained still to that thing that you rebel against. If you're chained to it, it means you are saying, no, I don't want it. So you're defining yourself by being the opposite of it. Your very definition of what you are is based upon contradicting something else. That means all of your energy is working to nullify something else, which means you're in continuous contact with it. You did not leave it. That's why in conversations with God, this phrase, what you resist persists, is such a deep wisdom, because it shows that to resist something means you have to stay in contact with it energetically. Think about it. The resistance means you are facing it. You are in contrast to it. You are in a force with it. You are totally connected to it. And so what you contemplate all the time, you become. So when you are absorbed in a mythology of what you are in relationship to others, and others are absorbed in the mythology of what they are in relationship with you, you are both in complete union with illusion. Now, the foundation of what I am is not in illusion. It is unalterable. Therefore, it lasts, it persists, regardless of how I think about it, or anyone else thinks about it, or whether everything in the universe is destroyed. Yet, everything around me can be a product of illusion if I allow it to be so. So let's go back to defining ourselves. Let's go back to the beginning, so to speak. And let's see how we can adjust it so that we can truly manifest ourselves according to a real definition of what we are. And let's also discuss whether that's the best path to go. Now, absolutely, I would have to say, absolutely, without a doubt, this is not necessarily the best thing for everybody right now. Living a life of complete honesty, of complete clarity, of complete self-definition is not possible for everybody right now. Let's take the example of a child abused person, someone who was abused as a child, somebody who had to go through a trauma as a child. They may not even be aware that it's there in their consciousness. They've built a wall of protection around their psyche, around their emotions, to protect them from this trauma. And to demand that suddenly they have to throw away all their defense and come face to face with the reality of their situation and deal with it with a clear definition could destroy them. So this illusion, this network of illusion, acts as a protection until they develop enough courage, enough strength internally, and they are ready to see the truth and to do something about it. Therefore, from that point of view, not everybody's ready to face this very traumatic past they might have. So, again, this is something for those who are ready for it. This is a discussion right now about why, or when even, one is ready to become clear, to become aware. So at first there's this desire in the heart, yeah, I want to do something about it. I really want to do something about it. I've got to try to do something about it. And then that commitment takes place. And then a series of actions take place to try to work it out. And then one starts to reach out towards others to try to piece together life and try to understand more, to learn from some, to find some stability in others, to find some peace with other persons using processes and techniques. But ultimately one has to feel an internal strength, an internal courage, an internal capacity to reach out for truth. And when one actually has that strength, one has that courage, one has that security of one's situation, all of those things, very important, one can start to clarify the definition of what one is. Strength, stability, and confidence, these things are not easy to come by. They are the product of a lot of work. They are the product of a lot of help from all kinds of sources, people around us, and the universal sources which create circumstances to encourage us in that direction. And ultimately, it is that divine consciousness of the Supreme that is manifesting through everybody and manifesting through all things that is giving us the proper space we require to come to this point of confidence, security, and stability and strength. And this is what the Supreme is doing. This is the facility given by that divine harmony, to give this space within which each of us can find that place where we are securely what we are. I feel this is the real meaning of the phrase in Bhagavad Gita, everyone follows my path in all respects. Because it is that path which is created out of this facilitation of our discovery of our place of strength. Because many people do it in different ways, but yet we sometimes feel that to become confident in ourselves, we have to demand that what we are doing is best, what we are doing is right, and therefore everyone should do what we are doing. But that's not the way it is seen by the divine harmony, by the Supreme. Supreme gives facility to all according to the way they need it, not the way we think it should be. So this development of clarity is actually a divine facility. It is something which comes directly from the divine. It is within the framework of the process of self-realization, if you will, self-actualization, if you will, yoga, connection with the Supreme, or whatever. Now, it takes great courage to make a statement like, well, I'm actually like this, and I'm telling you honestly, I'm telling you sincerely, because I love you. And if you choose to terminate our relationship or transform our relationship accordingly, that is your right. Because I cannot keep up this illusion of what you think I am or how others have defined me. Because now I'm standing up for myself and saying, no, I am like this. Take it or leave it. I hope you take it. If you don't, it's your right. I won't criticize you for it. But I would like to maintain contact with you, but really according to what I am, not what you think I am. Now this is a very deep form of rebellion. It is not a rebellion born of contradiction. You're not trying to contradict anything. You're not resisting anything. In fact, you're doing the complete opposite. If I am dealing with your conception of me and I'm having to resist you finding out the truth, that's also a resistance. And therefore, I'm bound to the illusion of the concept. But if I simply just surrender and say, hey, look, I'm not going to fight with trying to please you. I'm like this. I feel like this. This is what I am. That doesn't change love. It doesn't change care. It doesn't change trying to be of service. But it defines us in a very clear way. And if people like us or don't like us after that, that's basically their problem. It becomes our problem if the love gets separated when we actually love them. But that, again, is something they initiated. In other words, if somebody loves you, they love you. But if somebody loves what you present yourself to be, they don't love you. And if they don't love you, and you do state what you are, and then they say that they're not interested in you, it really doesn't change the reality because they never were interested in you. Therefore, one should have no fear in expressing themselves as they are. One should have no fear. It is nothing to be afraid of. Yet we have to still do it sensitively, with awareness of the other persons, awareness of the situation that we've been in for so long. It has to be done carefully. But not everybody can do this. Not everybody is ready to do this. If you don't feel so much self-confidence, if you don't feel security within yourself, if you don't feel stability within yourself, you won't be able to do this because it takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of fearlessness. You have to be a warrior. This is that spiritual warrior people are talking about. Yet life is complex. It's not so simple. There may be circumstances and situations where even somebody who is a warrior would not want to disturb the status quo of the situation. There are times when the arrangements around us would contrast totally, or would contradict totally the strategy of complete honesty. It would destroy certain foundations which we depend on for our material subsistence. Now, we have seen that often we become captured by circumstances, because reality around us is often much more complex, much stronger, much more powerful than we are. Therefore, it's not totally 100% under our control what we can do and when we can do it. Yet still, to that extent it is under our control, we can, when we feel so that we should do it, when we feel a calling to do it, we can try to define ourselves very clearly. Because it is this definition, it is this clear definition which defines what we are, which defines what we are to ourselves, and relegates all relationships to a kind of a restriction or demand for truthfulness, for honesty, for real empathy and real connection heart to heart. And therefore, when we are ready, when we feel that calling to do so, to define ourselves is a very great facility. And let's give an example of how we would define ourselves. Now, how it has affected me, this understanding of self-definition, is that if I really want to have deep relationships with others, and that is a question, do I take the steps necessary? Do I take the risks necessary to manifest them? Let's take the question, do I want to have deep relationships with others? Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that, well, this is the way I am. I like these deep relationships. I like this deep interaction. But no, in the sense that, well, too much of that, I'll get totally exhausted because it's so demanding. So I'm going to have to act like an organization. Part of this organization will have a deep relationship with a very few persons, and it will have a medium kind of relationship with a very few persons, and then it'll have some kind of surface relationship with a lot of people. Now, this definition is a necessity because I'm a limited person. I only have so much capacity, and therefore I have to regulate how my energy will flow because of my small capacity. God is everybody's favorite because God has unlimited capacity for deep relationships. God can have a deep relationship with every single living being in the whole creation and not feel drained by it. Therefore, everybody thinks God's okay. Of course, some people don't care about God, some people hate God, but you know what I mean. I'm talking about amongst those who consider it. But we are limited. We have a small capacity for emotional traumas or stress and demands, because when we have deep relationships, people put demands on us. We have to fulfill them. So we have to limit. We have to adjust relationships accordingly. Otherwise, we can't survive. Every one of us have this problem. When you acknowledge what you are doing when you do this, when you honestly explain the situation to others that, well, I can't really commit to so much. I can give you so much and not more. That's all I can do. You are giving them the respect they deserve. You are respecting them by not allowing them to live within the illusion of what they think the relationship is. In what I'm doing here in this weekly discussions or any writing that I may do, and I know I've been a little bit slow on that lately because I've been doing a lot of technical stuff. I'm giving you what I can give you. You cannot get more. It's like that's what it is. What you see is what you get. And I'm happy to give. But there are limits. There are limitations. And I want you to know those limitations. Because when this is not clearly defined, then I can be placed in a situation which is compromising my personal integrity. And I think that you can see from my experience how this can affect you in your own life, in your own experience, with all the demands that people put on you by their conceptions of you. I've been amazed lately about some people telling me how they think I thought about them. I go like, wow, that is so completely divorced from reality. Yet for me to correct that distorted view requires that I make such a personal commitment to energetic work of trying to express the reality, trying to define what is. I may often say, it's not worth it. I can't do it. I don't have the time. My general service will be disturbed by that. Therefore, each of us, I'm not special in any way, each of us have this situation where sometimes we just have to not care too much about certain persons, or to define ourselves in relationships to others in another way, and to deal with rejection, and to deal with overextension, and to deal with the stress of our lives, and to dare to bare our hearts and bare our souls to another and say, and really mean it, I love you. And to actually even stand before the deities, and to do that, knowing all the commitment it means, all of the work it means, all of the demand it means, energetically, to stand in front of the deities and say, I love you. And to connect with them in that love, to feel their love. It's so much of a commitment. We are speaking here of the fundamental way in which we define ourselves. And the honest and courageous way in which we share that with others out of respect for others, regardless of our own demands and needs. And yet it's not really so much courage required, because what you're really saying is, love me as I am. Because if you love what I'm not, you don't love me. You love some mask, some charade. So the basic foundation of our lives is a deep respect for ourselves. And the correction of all of this illusion is to have confidence in ourselves, to feel stability in ourselves and strength in ourselves to such an extent that we can say, I am like this. People have to accept us for what we are. That's all there is to it. That is how the Supreme does it. That is how the Divine does it. The Divine energies all throughout this universe are supporting us as we are, not supporting our illusions. And again, these illusory situations are not really illusory, because they are part of the facilitation that is given to us to bring us gradually to the point where we can feel that security, we can feel that confidence and self-respect. And from that point, to establish our spirituality in a very integrated and healthy way with this world. Okay, why don't you give me your oral question first?
All right. In English, so the question is, when people project on me their definitions of me, what they think about me, this often means some flow of negative energy towards me. And I don't want, or sometimes even can't, just burn this energy. Is it normal if I don't accept this energy, but just let it hang in the air, so to speak, or just redirect it into the earth, will it have some negative influence on other people or on me, or will it accumulate in this way?
Okay. There are a few things involved in this, and answering the question will require to go through a variety of factors, which I will do briefly, Now, why are people sending you this negative energy? That's the first and foremost and primary thing that needs to be addressed. So, the primary thing is to understand what it is about yourself, what it is about your energy, what it is about your relationship, what it is about everything that you have defined and everything you have done that has created this situation. Now, usually our response would be to just simply reject others as being crazy or insane or envious or a whole bunch of things. And that is not necessarily the best thing to say. Now, of course, it may also be true, but for us, it is very important to understand our part in fueling the situation which has created that reaction of negativity towards us. When we accept our part in that, when we accept our responsibility in that, we will be better able to deal with it. Sometimes this continuous, or shall we say consistent way in which reactions are sent to us is a indicator of our doing something wrong, or our having to learn something about ourselves and about the way we act. These situations which continually come to us, these situations which continually manifest, are indicators that there is something we have to do, there is something we have to learn, there is something we have to go beyond. Some transformation has to take place. And simply dealing with negating this and negating that and transforming this and transforming that, I mean, you will have to do that anyway. I'm not saying you shouldn't. But it's not the root of the problem. It is not really addressing the problem. Now, when you have a headache and you take an aspirin or you take some painkiller, that doesn't address the root cause of the headache. However, if you don't address the headache, it can just get worse and worse and worse and worse. So you do have to address it. But to address it at the root cause is a whole big process. Now, it is very hard to understand why people send negativity to you. Obviously, there are external reasons for this being so. External reasons are there, yes. But there are also internal reasons. Those you can address. The external reasons in the other person, you can also address if you're very powerful, but not necessarily everybody can do that. For instance, you might be able to do some like external healing on the person, or you may be able to do some kind of sending of angels or love, or sending down beautiful violet or white energy on for the person. These things you can do. Sending good love and good energy as a response to the negativity. Often, that's all people need. People are upset with being neglected or rejected. Now, of course, you may have also done something which was wrong. You may have to directly address that. You may have to apologize, or you may have to rectify that which you have done wrong. That is also possible, and that you have to do something about. Now, to directly answer your question, according to the way you have phrased it, I thought my first part of the answer was according to the way I would have wanted to answer it anyway, but according to the way you have phrased it, yes, you have to deal with these energies. I do not like to pour negativity into the earth. I don't like to use the earth as a garbage can. I like to gather up all the energy and capture all the negativity and then burn it up. And then that flame will disintegrate it all, and then some wind that you create will just blow it all away into space. And you can send a big wall to that person and just block off all their energies. It's not so good to put the wall near you, because then the energies are there. You push the wall up against them so that their energies are blocked immediately before it even comes anywhere near you. And then, if you really need to do it, although I don't recommend this necessarily, you can put a mirror, a spherical mirror, you can place them into a sphere of mirror which will just reflect all their negativity back to them. Now that's not necessarily good, because that's kind of nasty in a way. After all, what if the negativity they're expressing towards you is a response to something that you have done which is not right? You've somehow hurt them. And therefore, what you are doing is hurting them even more. So you're just amplifying your own, shall we say, your own crime, not really crime, but your own the situation that you've created, you're making it worse. And sometimes this energy is there to cause a transformation within you. So you are blocking off your own transformation capacity, or potential is a better word. So you have to decide how you want to deal with it. But once you understand your role within it, it becomes obvious which particular response you should make. And again, this is not easy, because it takes a lot of strength and capacity to be able to see your own faults and your own responsibility in the situation. So has this helped? Has this answer helped, been of assistance to the person who asked the question? Okay. Now I've got another question here, which I think represents a situation which a lot of people feel similar to in some way. Not those, I think, who have been around for a while, but especially those who are new to these sessions. Well, actually, I have no idea. Maybe I said that all wrong. Maybe I'm creating an improper impression about this question. But anyway, I'll just explain it. You can fit it in whatever way you want into your own consciousness. Now, this person is asking something which I'm going to have a very hard time answering in any other way than to be just completely honest, and I just hope you accept it the way it is. This person feels that our relationship between me and this person has been predetermined from birth, that I am that person's guide in this world, who conducts that person back to God. Now, is that love that this person feels for me as that guide, is this an illusion, or is this real? Now, this is a very complex question, even though it seems to be very kind of obvious, because it's not an illusion for you to feel some way about someone else. It's the way you feel about someone else. And even if the other person says, no, that's not the way it is, but if that other person is somehow offering and rendering a service like that, the other person can't say, no, it's not so. In other words, I can't say now, no, it's not so. I can simply tell you what it is from my point of view. In a very simple way, I can tell you, this is what I've got to offer. I can guarantee you that when I speak here on Saturday or any other time, I am trying my very, very best to say something which is helpful, which is of service, which is proper, and which is to the best of my experience and realization and capacity to be true. In other words, I'm guaranteeing you're getting the best out of me I can give. I'm not guaranteeing this is the best there is. I'm not guaranteeing any result of what you get out of this. All I can guarantee is you're getting out of me the very best I can give you. I can guarantee you, when I write answers on the forums or I write to you, that I think about this very carefully and I try to give you the very best responses I can give you. And when I do personal counseling sessions, I can guarantee that I'm trying my very best to be of service and to tell you frankly and honestly what I see. I cannot give you more guarantee than that. I cannot guarantee that I'm representing anybody. I cannot guarantee you I'm representing any tradition. I cannot guarantee you I'm quoting from some authorities. I can guarantee you you're getting what I give. I can guarantee you that I'm giving according to my own realization, my own experience, and my own understanding of what is true. I do not present myself as somebody who conducts you in some way, who's leading you in some way. But I can say I'm trying my best to help you find your way. And I like to be there to support you in that search. I like to be there and support you in your journey in whatever way I can. I cannot guarantee that you get where you're going fast. I cannot guarantee any time frame. I cannot guarantee any success other than that which you attain by your own endeavors. To whatever degree my guarantee or my, shall we say, a declaration of what I can do or can't do fits within your conception of me, to that degree, it is real. And to that degree, your expectation or your demands on me are outside of what I can give. To that degree, you're not really in harmony with what I'm offering you. Now, it does seem to me, I mean, as a philosophical point outside of the answer to this question, that's all anyone can ever do for anyone else. But sometimes we place our service within a context which gives it an appearance of being more than that. But ultimately, that's all anyone can really do for anyone else. I do believe firmly that people come in contact with other people because of divine providence. And that's definitely not an illusion. So I hope that my answer has shed some light on your problem. So you can tell me whether or not I have answered your question or not. So you can let me know. Somebody is asking me that it seems that from October 21st on, we're moving in some direction, in some organized form. And I answered him that, well, I'm just helping to clarify the organism and making it very clear what we're doing here, that in fact something is happening. It is not that nothing is happening. And definitely I feel an urge to clarify because it's important to me to be very honest and open in what's going on, because I would hate for some illusion to interrupt this very nice mood we have, this very nice exchange we have. Now, here's a very related question that this person is saying, that sometimes people around him refuse to perceive the declaration of his own nature, preferring to support their own illusion. That's very interesting. And it seems to such in such times that just simply declaring what is not sufficient to clarify. And that when you make an effort to destroy the illusions, this brings such a great pain to people. It can hurt people. So what's better, to force the situation towards honesty or to leave it as it is? Which is better? Now that is a very good question, because it is the kind of a question which will direct how we plan or how we work out these difficulties, the way in which we execute some kind of honesty in relationships. It's a very important question. I can tell you from my own practical experience that making radical changes which nobody can figure out or understand is not necessarily the best way to do it. But sometimes the situation is so far beyond us, sometimes the forces are so powerful, it's very hard to do anything else. But when it is under your control, when you do have the capacity to majorly influence what is happening in your life, I would suggest you make a very dedicated and determined and steady effort to transform the relationship, but not try to force it. The word force is the word that I object to. You should not try to force it, but you should try to transform it. Nobody can force anything. I mean, of course you can try, but you cannot really create change like that through force. Because when you try to push like that with such force, it generally creates an atmosphere of a warlike atmosphere of conflict. And that's not necessarily what you want to do. So leaving it alone and forcing it, neither of these are very good. You have to try to create a circumstance or an environment within which transformation can take place. Because transformation is something that can be regulated with love, that can be dictated to by love, it can be fueled by love, whereas force is something which is contrast to love. Love is never forced. It is something which flows. Now, the next question, I think, is a very fascinating question. I think it's naturally, I have to say, it comes from Kamalamala. He always asks questions which are very, go straight to the heart of a situation. I mean, I don't know how he does it, but anyway, he does it. And so, I think it's the one question that can tip to one way or another our response to this situation of dealing with something we resist. Now, it's a very complex question, even though it's a couple of lines. When I said what you resist persists, then he immediately is asking me about temptations, the seductions, the way in which the world around us tempts us into or seduces us into things which may not be good for us, or may be very dangerous, or may be very contrary to what is our nature. Naturally, this is the very nature of the conflict, the duality of this world. It is the subject matter of every religion since time immemorial. It is the very basic root conflict for every single spiritualist since time immemorial. Because it deals with spirituality and sensuality, these two seemingly opposite things. For example, do you feel tempted to go out and murder somebody? Do you feel tempted to go out and rob a bank? Do you feel tempted to jump off the roof? Do you feel tempted to go out, let's say, and smoke cigarettes? Do you feel tempted to go out and drive your car on the wrong side of the road? Do you feel tempted just because somebody dares you to do something wild? Do you feel tempted to do that? No, no. Think about it. The things that you don't like don't tempt you, isn't it? The things that you do like do tempt you. Now the question is, why do you like that? You understand? It's like in the Christian prayer it says, lead us not into temptation. And forgive us if we get into that temptation. If we accept it, then forgive us. Now, why would God create a situation which places us in this temptation that is presented to us, the most pleasurable things in the world, and then condemn us for taking them? Because they're so much more powerful than us. Why would God do that? God is some kind of sadist who would do that. What kind of sadist would prepare the most wonderful feast and serve it right before you when you're starving and then demand you sit there and not eat a thing. So I think the only way to really deal with this conflict between spirituality and sensuality, which, by the way, we've talked about in a whole lecture, I don't remember if it's uploaded on the site or not, is to understand what it is you like and why you like it, and to accept it as part of the energy of God, part of the energy of spirituality, part of the energy of what it means to be alive. It is this sensuality which gives us a passion for life. If you have no passion for life, you cannot live. Now, let's say you're very relaxed about your situation. You're relaxed. You don't feel any specific need to fight against anything because you're not afraid of anything. Then you can decide whether or not you will be involved in something based on all kinds of other considerations, not just because you like it. Whereas those who are pushing away, resisting anything sensual are often those who just at one point lose their mind completely and dive totally mindlessly into sensuality and get devoured by it. Whereas those who are more relaxed and not in such a conflict, they choose. They say that this particular thing which is there, do I want it or not? Well, no, because it's bad for my health, or it's bad for my economy, or it's bad for my relationship, or my family, or it's bad for my world, or I don't feel like doing it. No, it's not worth it to me. As soon as you say you can't have, you can't do, you want it. It is human nature. You know, people used to do these psychological experiments. They would sit somebody down and tell them, don't think of a pink elephant. Don't think of a pink elephant at all. And what do? You think of a pink elephant. It's just the nature of the mind. When it's restricted from doing something, it immediately wants to do it. Just like any child knows, whenever the parent says, don't do this, don't do this, children want to do it even more. I have seen statistics, believe it or not, that premarital sex is going down in popularity. Now that is an amazing thing. Previously, when they were teaching, this is bad, don't do it, it's not right, kids said, shoo, great, let's go out and do it as fast as possible. Now they're saying, look, you can get it anywhere, but there are these problems. Number one problem, besides getting pregnant for ladies, is lots of disease out there. Lots of disease. And they would like show pictures of the different diseases that people would get. And when they taught like that, by not saying, don't, they said, this is the result of that choice. In this many cases, they gave statistics. Kids woke up and said, whoa, I don't like the chances. So nobody has to convince you not to take poison. If you know what poison does, no one has to convince you of it. It's just that if you were convinced that poison was something that was a great drug, then you may be tempted by it. But knowing what it really is, immediately you're not tempted. So the more stress you have inside, the more you are fighting inside against something, the more your attraction towards it is confirmed, because you're fighting against it all the time. No sensuality, no sensuality, no sensuality. What's happening? You're constantly in contact with your direct desire for sensuality. So instead of something that you deal with on a case-by-case basis when it comes to you, it's something you have to deal with all the time. So it's something that wears you down, it's something that makes you weak, it's something that makes you sick, it's something that makes you dull as a person. So another question would be, what's the difference of a spirit living in a pure state and a soul in duality? But the very question answers it. The duality is, you've got the fight between the sensuality and the fight between the spirituality. And naturally, for those who like a good fight, they will appreciate that. But that is the nature of duality, to create a fight where there is none. In the pure state, the conflict doesn't exist. It's only in the state of duality that we create the conflict and then suffer from it. So I hope that has helped answer the question.